on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 91-year-old Chuck Betty of Modesto, California. He was just 18 years old and had been on the USS Yorktown for just days when that aircraft carrier suffered what would prove to be fatal wounds in the Battle of Midway in early June of 1942. Wounded in the knee by one of the first Japanese bombs that hit, he was still aboard, feeling pretty helpless as the battle raged on and bombs and torpedoes continued to batter the Yorktown. The battle started June the 4th. The Yorktown went under in the early morning hours of June 7th. Like the rest of the wounded, Chuck was evacuated before the ship went under. But for all that time, while you're still on the ship, unable to do anything to defend it, what was going through your mind?
You're worried. You don't know what's going to happen next because of the beating that she was taking at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, you just wondered, well, is she going to stand it? Are they going to sink it right now or what? You just really didn't know.
What would have happened to you if they did sink it?
Well, you don't know, really, Paul, what's going to happen. Of course, they take as much of the crew off as they can. I guess going by it in the past and reading the history of it, they took a lot of the wounded off after they realized she was going to sink, another possibly sink. Mm-hmm. It's when they started taking all of the crew and everything else off of her. So you knew that something was happening that wasn't good when they started doing the evacuation that way.
And again, I'm just going to ask you a few crazy questions because I wasn't there. None of us were. You were. The timing of it all, when you were wounded, that preventing you from continuing to ferry this ammunition, could that have saved you from getting injured worse?
Oh, I'd say yes, definitely. I think it could have saved me, saved my life, actually, let's put it that way. Because you didn't know the way that the attack that was being made on her, why it was... anybody. The ship could have been hit anywhere, and there were a number of them that were killed during that attack that were up on the deck.
Yeah. So there's no telling where you would have been. Because you covered so much ground in that role, and one of those bombs or torpedoes could have killed you.
Killed you, right.
But instead, you're recuperating. They finally evacuate you. When did you find out that the Yorktown sank?
Oh, we knew that about 4 days or a week, something like that, that they tried to salvage her because she was listening and everything.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say it was probably word got out almost immediately at the time that they really abandoned her and called her lost. They gave word to the crew, the people that were in the hospital and the crews that had been abandoned and put elsewhere on the shore. They just got the news that way.
But you knew when you were getting off the ship that there was a chance that might happen.
Oh, yes. Yeah, because she was, when they took us off, she was pretty badly damaged.
Was that still, I know you hadn't been on the ship very long, but was that hard to hear that it had gone under?
Oh, yeah, you do, because the war at that time, in other words, was going, before the Battle of Midway, the war was going the Japanese way. Mm-hmm. And having to lose a ship like that that could give so much more to the war, you just felt sad for it. I mean, it was just something hard to take, unless a good ship like that. Now, there are others that were lost also, but, I mean, the one that you're aboard, you're more...
And that was the biggest one.
Right.
That was the carrier.
Yes.
And, again, you're 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Is youth an advantage there? Do you not run through all the scenarios in your mind, or do you find yourself saying, boy, all those guys died, that could have been me?
Well, right, you do. You know, I don't... In my part... I don't know. I can't say that I was scared, but I really wasn't real scared. I don't know how to say it.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, the things that we went through in the service, I just had no fear. I'll put it that way. I did have sense enough to have fear, maybe. And at that age, I think that's what it is for most young people.
Mm-hmm.
That.
Well, I was guessing that you didn't have any fear because here you are, the first ship that you're on. Get sunk by the Japanese, and you go and volunteer for submarine duty. Because I don't know if everyone understands this, but if you are going to wear the dolphins like you're wearing on your submarine vest right now, that takes volunteering during World War II. It wasn't something they were going to assign you to. You had to step up and say, yeah, I want to do that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What possessed you to do that?
I had talked to a fellow that was aboard a submarine, and when he was in the hospital that I had met and was aboard the submarines, and he said, just tell me this, how good a service it was and everything. You got good food and everything like that. And it was kind of exciting. So, And there was another chance that if I volunteered for submarines, I knew I was going to be sent back to the States.
Uh-huh.
Because I knew I'd be going back to submarine school.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And I shouldn't gloss over that either. You mentioned being in the hospital. How long did it take you to recover?
About, I was in the hospital a little short of 3 months.
That's quite a long time.
Yeah, it was a little short of 3 months.
You say your knee got splintered. That's a pretty severe injury to keep you down for 3 months.
Yeah, of course, I say 3 months. It was probably the last 20 days or so. I thought I was well and everything. I could have gone out of the hospital. But, mm-hmm. of course, the doctors and that, they're the ones that are going to tell you where you're going, if you can get off or not. So.
Sure. And, again, I know you're not asking for sympathy, but be honest with me. Is that something that did fully recover, or has that knee bothered you ever since?
Fortunately, fully recovered. Fortunately, I had the doctor at the submarine said when I went back to submarine school, there was a doctor there that was a specialist in bone structure.
Uh-huh.
They operated again there and put screws and that into in that. So mobility wise, I have trouble occasionally with it, but I don't. It's never stopped me from doing anything.
I can tell you're getting around great for 91. Yeah. So you say volunteer for the submarines, and part of that was going back to the States. So you know I'm not going to get sent right back out into the war. I'm going to have some time at home to train.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Was that training difficult?
No, it was not for me. It wasn't anyway. Some of it was kind of exciting, and you have the tower that's a 138-foot tower that you put a Munson lung on and put you down at the bottom of it, and then you're supposed to go up that 138 feet with that Munson lung.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some people, it was startling and everything, but you were breathing air out of the lung.
Yeah.
But some of them couldn't quite stand it. Some of them just couldn't do it.
And if you can't do that, you're not going to be able to submerge.
Right. You're disqualified. Mm-hmm. They were very, at that time, they were probably most lenient on who could get on and who couldn't get off. But there were some of the things that if a person could be confused or startled like that, that you just didn't accept it.
And you were just showing me some pictures of you aboard the World War II submarine Pampanito that's in San Francisco. You can go visit it and tour it. And anyone who's done that realizes that submarines in World War II were a lot different from what we know today.
Definitely they are. We had more room than they do today.
But you couldn't stay under as long as they
could. No, that's true. We couldn't.
And you got used to the smell of diesel, didn't you?
Never bothered me. Smell never bothered me at all. Uh-huh. In fact, I don't remember the smell of diesel. To me, I never did.
Yeah?
No.
Well, explain to folks how those diesel submarines would work, that you guys would have to surface how often to charge the batteries?
Well, you did it daily is what it did. Generally, as a rule, it was at night that you're up running at night. You would run on the surface a lot of the times.
Mm-hmm.
And that time, of course, you were charging the batteries. I think the longest that I can remember that we were down was 72 hours, which was quite a while. In other words, the oxygen began to get a little thin and that, but other boats have been down longer than that. Mm-hmm. But it's entirely different, like you say, the new boats today.
And they are boats. Don't call a submarine a ship. No, it's not a ship. It's a boat.
I don't, right.
And the first boat you were on was the Bashaw?
Bashaw. Mm-hmm. I did one patrol aboard her.
Where were you guys?
Out of Fremantle, Australia. They had the submarine tender there called the Uralie. Pull along there for repairs and that in between patrols.
And what was your position on that sub?
A torpedoman. Before I did that, to get out to the islands, to Australia, after I got through submarine school, they signed me to a repair base in Brisbane, Australia. At that time, we used to have the Lurline used to go between San Francisco and Hawaii as a cruise ship.
Mm-hmm.
She could do 27 knots, so they sent us to Australia with no escort whatsoever. We just went by ourselves. And we got into Brisbane and the crew there, and we stayed there 3 weeks, and they shipped us to all the way across to Australia to Fremantle.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it took us, we went by train, and then in Australia, every state you got into, they changed the gauge, so you had to change trains and everything. It took us 9 days to go from Brisbane across to Fremantle.
Wow.
But,
this is a whole lot of the world you're seeing as a teenager and a young man here.
It is. But then, as I say, when I got over the relief crew over there, I was only on the relief crew about less than 6 weeks when Brashaw came in off of patrol. And my rating was torpedoman, and they had a torpedoman that advanced in his rating, and that put them too many men in that same rating, in other words. So they transferred them to another ship, and then I went aboard her as a third. At that time, I was third-class torpedoman when I went aboard her.
Explain to all of us how that works. If you are in a situation where a torpedo is going to be fired, what are the steps that you go through?
Well, of course, both times I was in the forward torpedo room. When you go into battle, you prepare your tubes and everything for firing. You're waiting for your commanding officer to tell you to fire. Of course, most of the firing was done in the conning tower by an officer. If we had to be, we could fire from up there if an emergency came on. But outside of that, we were just waiting. And that was, if we did fire the torpedoes, immediately we were putting new torpedoes in the tubes to have them filled.
Mm-hmm. So. And that is one thing you can see if you go to San Francisco and visit the Pampanito there, that they do have a torpedo in the tube. And you can get a pretty good look at how that worked. So you say you made the one patrol.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that took you from that boat to the other boat, the Sea Robin?
Well, because of the fact that the Sea Robin needed a third-rate torpedoman.
Uh-huh.
And the Bashaw.
You had more than you needed.
More than they needed. So that's when I went to relief crew and then immediately was transferred to the Sea Robin after that.
On your vest right now, you're wearing a couple patches that pay tribute to the Sea Robin.
Sea Robin.
You've got a couple of birds riding a torpedo, and the other one has a whole lot of Japanese flags around it.
Yeah, that's from the Sea Robins. That's her flag.
Yep.
And the
and that means that that boat took out a lot of Japanese ships.
Right, they did. Mm-hmm. They had a pretty good record for that. Late in the war, we had a pretty good record.
Tell me about that. What would give me an example of one of those patrols where you guys encountered Japanese ships and then were able to sink them?
We run on surface wherever it was possible, enough without endangering the boat. Some of these that we sank during the day, but a number of them were at night. You got excited about it when it was happening.
That's what I was curious how. Yeah. It's not like you guys all have a window or a TV screen.
No.
Or even a radar readout. How does that word spread, and what is that like on a submarine when you find out, hey, that torpedo hit its target?
Well, the thing of it is, when you fire a torpedo off, you always were waiting for to hear the explosion and that. Or, of course, the commanding officer a lot of time was on the intercom when they say, well, they're looking through the periscope, you can see it. Well, it was broken in two. The ship was destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where you got your word, what was going on from the torpedo that you fired.
And then what happens on the boat when that announcement comes?
Oh, everybody's, you're... Well, good. We done something. We sunk something.
Yeah, a little cheering.
Really, you just got ready for the next one. Is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you were in an area where you had five or six ships, so you was hoping, well, you got the one. Can we get another one out of the same group? But the majority of the times you didn't, because it was by the time you fired that got off. Well, a lot of times you had the Japanese were. After you, in other words, they got contact with you, and they were trying to sink you, too. So.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. And when you were on the Yorktown, I know it ended up sinking, but had you been aboard as it's going down, at least you would have been able, maybe, to survive in the water. If you're on a submarine, and you get hit by depth charges, I don't think you're surviving.
In order to sink a submarine, the depth charge has to be awful close to it. I mean, I'm real close to do it. Where a lot of times we heard depth charges, but they were off at a distance to where they were doing no damage, but you'd hear them going off.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them that were a little closer, you kind of gritted your teeth a little bit. But I just don't know. I don't think I ever remember one or felt that I was scared because of it. Maybe I didn't have sense enough to, but I didn't have any fear of what it was.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask you. I know you've got a story of one of your own torpedoes almost took out the Sea Robin, and I want to get to that. But as far as any Japanese threat to your boat, what was maybe the closest call or most nerve-wracking moment you experienced?
Of course, I think it was when we did get into a convoy, and we sank one of the ships, and then the Japanese destroyers were more or less targeted on us and were dropping depth charges constantly. And of course, at that time, most of the time you go into silent running and you just try to get right down on the ocean bottom, just sit down on the ocean bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And bending somewhere, rocked the boat. I mean, close enough to rock the boat in that, but there was none of them at any time that I knew that ever had was a danger to the sea robin. They just weren't that close.
When you talk about diving deeper and sitting as low as you can, is that a helpless feeling while you're waiting that out? Is there a sense of expecting something to happen?
You always know that something can happen. You're in silent running, so the best thing you do, you don't talk, you don't do anything. You just sit there and be quiet.
So you're alone with your thoughts.
You're alone with your thoughts, really, is what it is. And you can talk. There's no that. And amongst yourselves and everything, you're talking. And it's just a conversation going on. Well, are they getting any closer, or how long are we going to be down, or what? I mean, it's just like that. It was just abnormal not to be afraid, I'll put it that way. And I think that's where a submarine sailor had it over a lot of them, because they, I don't know, it was just the idea that you could face problems a little easier. And myself, I'm comparing myself back to the Yorktown. Mm-hmm. In other words, the difference between the two.
I guess you were a little older and more mature by then, too, but you lived both realities, so you're pretty qualified to speak to it. It's break time again, but more of Chuck Betty's story, including how one of his submarine's own torpedoes almost ended the war for him. Check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.